what I want as a legacy is I want people, like in the name Crooked Mocker, I want people to kind of be unbound in how they think. Be a standout. Stand up to big business, and in my case, big soda and big industry, and do it for all the right reasons. And don't be afraid to fail as you're doing it.
What's up, y'all? It's me here, Michael Franti, and welcome to this week's edition of the Stay Human podcast. I've been looking forward to having this guy on the show for about 6 weeks when I first heard he was coming on, and I did a deep dive in everything he's done. But before we get into it, man, I just got to say that I use your product, and I'll talk more about that as we get into it. But our guest today on the Stay Human show, which is presented today by Gibson Guitars, he founded the antioxidant beverage company Bai in his basement in 2009 and quickly built it into the fastest growing brand in the industry. And with Bai, he led a bevolution against giant soda, sugary, you know, crazy ass soft drink companies by delivering a great tasting drink without mounds of that nasty sugar and artificial ingredients. And the Dr. Pepper Snapple group snapped them up by in 2017 for a tidy $1.7 billion. And now he is continuing his bevolution with Crook and Marker, the world's first fully USDA organic alcohol beverage portfolio. And Crook and Marker launched nationally in early 2019 and is now a leading brand in the quote-unquote better for you alcoholic beverage category, achieving triple digit sales growth while rapidly expanding its roster of major retail partners. So please welcome to the show entrepreneur and now author of the new book Basementality, Ben Weiss. What's up, Ben?
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the kind words.
Ah, man, I'm super, super stoked to have you because, you know, I got to say, when Bai first came out, I'm somebody who has battled sugar addiction pretty much my entire life. And as an adult, there was, I don't know, maybe like about 12, 13 years ago, I decided to stop drinking sugary soft drinks. And I went to, you know, sparkling water. I went to everything I could, you know, juices, until I found out that how much, you know, when you're just juicing juices, you're just pulling the sugar out of the fruit. And there's a lot of calories there too. And so when Bai came along and I tried it on tour, like we were in a truck stop somewhere and I was like, what is this? It's like, I can't even remember what it was, like blueberry acai, something like that. Sounded like really good to me. And I got it and I was like, damn, this shit is good, man. And I remember going back in and buying some for the guys in the band and everybody trying it. And then it replaced all the other stuff that we had on our rider. And we went full in on it and it became a part of our tour experience. And so, man, I just first of all want to just say thank you for creating an alternative to you know, sugary stuff.
Beverages just kind of play a very specific role in people's lives. It's intimate, you know, you're ingesting it. Often you're ingesting it multiple times a day. So if you think about that, you have to have a relationship with that drink. And that drink often speaks to, you know, your lifestyle. So it, you know, it brings like-minded people, and I'd like, maybe we are like-minded, which is pretty cool too, together. That's the beauty of beverage, is that it can find people like that and connect them.
You know, my wife and I have a saying, it's kind of one of our mottos here at our hotel, and it's 100% healthy 90% of the time. And
you got to have that 10% in your life, right?
You got to have that 10% in your life. And that's what that's where the living is, you know? And that's the thing is, when I was trying to kick the sugary soft drink habit, it was like, I missed
I missed the flavor. Because usually you guys get flavor.
Yeah.
usually, Michael, to get flavor, you have to give up and you have to compromise. And that's what I think made Vi so special, is that it can play that role in your life, especially how we ultimately innovated into all these different types of beverages. Because I like to say we stumbled upon the answer to the diet dilemma. We figured out how to make 5 calories really good without sacrificing flavor and using artificial sweeteners. And when we did that, we just innovated it across different platforms. We did a tea, we did lemonades, we did enhanced waters, we did bubbles. And what we were doing in creating that innovation is we were giving people the opportunity to rethink what they drink, but we were also, as I come to learn, we were really stressing the relationship with the distributor. And the thing is with beverage, in order to disrupt the beverage industry, you almost have to align with the very people that you're looking to disrupt, right? So you often have to wind up on a Coke truck, a Pepsi truck, or in our case, a Dr. Pepper Snapple truck. And those are the three route to markets that'll get you mass availability. Yeah. So it's kind of like this catch 22 where you're working alongside them, but you're really trying to take them down. And that's where we find the Bevolution. You know, it's a fight against the same partners that you need in order to get to the consumer. And that's where a lot of great brands go to die, because they don't know how to build distribution equity. So at the end of the day, Michael, it's way more than having a product that tastes good and looks good on a shelf, or in a Super Bowl commercial or on a billboard. You know, it's all about building this equity and, you know, fighting for shelf space when, quite frankly, they own other brands that they'd rather give it to.
Yeah.
But you had said something earlier that I think is important. I wanted to just touch on. You had said that, you know, you gave up sugar maybe 15 years ago. And the reality is we're all trained from a very young age to eat sugar, right? Like you do something good, you get a piece of candy. You have a birthday, you have birthday cake. And listen,
the best day of the year is Halloween, you know?
Halloween's the best. And you know what? I love the 10%, that little 10% you're talking about, because that's when you do enjoy that. And listen, I love sugar. I just want to be able to enjoy my sugar elsewhere. So I need to find my 10%. So what's ironic is that beverages in the US, beverages comprise 70% of the sugar consumption. It comes from beverages. Wow. Think about that for a second. So if you could eliminate sugar from that part of your diet and not sacrifice by just drinking a seltzer with a little bit of flavor, but actually having big flavor, not consuming the sugar, well, then go have a piece of birthday cake. You know, I'm not like a guy who says don't eat sugar. I'm just a guy that says you don't have to drink sugar.
Yeah.
You don't and have sugar to drink in a your beverage. Calories. Yeah. Drinking your calories is tough because it's liquid candy. So it goes right into your bloodstream. It's often the worst type of sugar, which is high fructose corn syrup. So you kind of want to avoid it at all costs. And in 2017, I think it was the first year, Michael, where consumers drank more water than they did soda. That was the first time that's ever happened. Wow. So they're aware of it. There's a movement. We were just leading it with big, bold flavor.
That's awesome. I want to know about where this fight in you came from, you know? And I just want to learn about your life. So where did you grow up and what was your family like?
Yeah. So I grew up in New York, and I'm a borough boy. I grew up in Staten Island. And, you know, I went to college in Boston. My parents moved to California. So I've been removed from Staten Island for a while, but those were my roots. You know, I come from, you know, middle-class family, where the mom was the breadwinner, because my parents got divorced when I was 7. So I think my mother being a working mom really influenced me. And
well, tell
raised
me about
by
that.
My mom.
Did you have other brothers and sisters too in the house?
I have a sister, Candice, who's a year and a half older than me. But you know, you say where'd the fight come from? And it's a great question. It really is, because I'm not by nature an angry guy. but I'm an angry CEO. And I know how to channel that anger. Because I had a father who, before my parents got divorced, there was a lot of anger that came out of him. He did not know how to control his anger. And and often he lashed out at the very people he loved the most. And I think...
How early in your life do you remember that?
Oh, I remember fighting as a very big part of my growing up. And it's funny because my mother's not a fighter. Like, she's not a yeller at all. It came from that direction. It came from my father. Yeah. So it was always part of the household, just because he was a bit of a broken man. He was a good guy. He just did, he didn't know how to control that emotion.
What was his, what did he do? What was his, you say he was broken. What was his experience?
So he gave me all of my creativity. He was a very creative guy. He owned an advertising agency. He was a very creative guy, a very bad businessman, who ultimately just had a modest business. And in part, it was his personality flaws that I talked about that kind of found their way into business as well. It was just tough. It was a tough environment to be around. Extremely creative guy, though, and I thank him for that. And not a bad guy. You know, he's the type of guy who, Michael, I don't know if you can relate to this or not, but if he did lash out, he'd also be the guy as you storm out of his office, you'd see him in the window kind of crying because of what he did. He knew he was doing wrong as he was doing. He just couldn't control it. And it wasn't a physical thing. It was just a bad way of expressing himself. That, you know, was a part of my life for a while. He had passed away. And I was really raised by my mom and my stepdad, Ray, who has played a critical role in my life. And that fighting completely went away. It was not part of my upbringing. Yeah. But getting back to, you know, why I have fight in me, I don't think it's because of him. You know, I don't have that type of fight in me.
Yeah,
I have a fight. My fight comes specifically in business. I always say every day, like, I'm fighting with you, although this isn't a fight. Yeah. Fighting is just mental warfare. Like,
sparring.
It's sparring. Yeah. It's not like, you know, it's sparring. And what I'm trying to do is say, I have this really big vision of the future and I'm tethered to it. So good luck trying to convince me. And it's not arrogance. It's just like, you have to be that way. Right. Because the desire is for entrepreneurs to fail early on. Yeah. And I'm just so tethered to it. And I'm now saying either you see what I see, because maybe we're like-minded. Yeah. And if you don't, I'm trying to convince you of that vision. Yeah. And if you can't be convinced of that vision, I gotta push you out. At least the point I was trying to make, Michael, is that, you know, I think being angry benefited me in business. I also think being aware of how you use anger, I think there's an art to being angry.
When did that come to you? Because, you know, when I was a kid, I had a similar situation. I grew up with a really angry dad. He had two emotions. There was like silence and rage. And there wasn't like a whole lot in between. He's similar to your dad. He was a very creative guy. He was very, you know, intellectual and thoughtful, but emotionally he was crippled. You know, he just didn't know how to really.
It's a great word. That's how I would express my father. Is just crippled emotionally.
Yeah. And so where did this like awareness come for you? Because I remember there was a time when I was in about sixth grade and I got in this fight in school. Kids used to pick on me all the time because I was like the tallest, skinniest brown kid in a mostly white school. And there was one time I was in a fight with this guy. I grabbed him by the collar and I started like squeezing his collar and I was going to punch him. And it's something in my head just clicked. Like if I just kept squeezing him, like I could, like he could die.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't hit him and I let him go. And it was like this thing went off in my head. Like, yo, you're going down like a really bad path if you keep doing this. And I had to learn to find other outlets. And for me, it was like sports, music, arts and stuff like that. Cause school really wasn't my bag, you know, but what was it for you that kind of set you thinking like, I got to channel this differently.
Unfortunately, I wasn't the tallest kid in the school and basketball wasn't an option for me. Although I have a 6'5" son who has amazing 3-point shot.
Nice.
But, for me, I think what you experienced is you were very conscious of not being that guy. And I think in my life, I'm respectful of what that guy has given me, but also conscious of how I use what he's given me, because he's given me good and bad, right? That's just natural. And anger for me has been beneficial because it gives me my edge in business. Mm-hmm. Like, it's amazing.
Talk me through that. How does it show up for you?
I get mad if people don't, if they stand in the way of a good idea. Listen, if the idea is bad, and I've had bad ideas, don't get me wrong. I don't profess to nailing these things. Matter of fact, even my good ideas, you do these pivots along the way to make it a really good idea. But you got to be given that opportunity. And if you stand in my way, I get really, really angry. And that's where I kind of just kind of dig in. And instead of like, would you restrain yourself from hitting somebody? Like, my anger is not about lashing out at people. My anger is like, okay, now I'm digging in and you and I are going to go at it in a very salesmanlike way. I'm going to show you my vision and you're going to either believe it or you're going to say, I choose not to. And then I'm going to kind of push you away. I'm going to go through you. And that's the delicate part that you have to figure out. And it's a really hard, by the way, I didn't know this about me until after I sold Buy, because I was the same guy in every one of my businesses. I just didn't have a $1.7 billion exit at the end of any of them. And when you do that and then life stops, right? So I got fired from Dr. Pepper Snapple Group. I thought I'd still be there and we'd run hard together, but my life stopped. And when it stopped, I had this great luxury of writing this book alongside one of my closest friends, Eric Quiñones. And it was almost like therapy. And I gotta be honest with you, I learned a lot about myself and I started to fall in love with myself, because I was always the guy that said, I'm not the smartest guy in the room. I am not the most creative guy in the room. You know, I've always hired and inspired those people to be alongside me, but I didn't know why. Why did it need me? Why did the businesses need me? I get it, I created it, but why did it need me? And then every time I stepped away, the business faltered. And now on the other side of Buy, I'm starting a new business and I see it even more, the role that I play as an entrepreneur in that business. And I'm even more sensitive to that edge that is so required to cut through any business that you're trying to disrupt, anything that you're trying to disrupt. Because, you know, the reason why these brands are behemoths is because they have a role in society and they've been propped up now. As society has evolved, right? I told you the first year that people are drinking more water than carbonated soft drinks. The consumer's moved, right? But you've got these legacy brands that are so propped up, giving consumers not what they want. And that makes me angry, because I want them out of the way. I want just a fair shot in front of that consumer. And if they choose me, or if they don't choose me, I'll live with those consequences. But I don't like the fact that you sell more Snapple iced tea that has 56 grams of sugar than a brand that's on your trucks that tastes better with 5 calories and 1 gram of sugar. I can't accept that that's the right thing. So what do I do? I sell it to them. And I never really, that was my intent, but I felt like they needed to be more connected to the business. Because part of me understood, the businessman in me said, I get it, you own Snapple, you don't own us, you make more money off of selling them than you do us, it's your brand, so you sell it. Okay, now you own this great brand, you paid a ton of money for it, and yet I still see a Snapple Cola today that has more Snapple in it than Buy, and they own the brand. So it just, it continues to anger me that the consumer's not getting what they want.
Yeah. Let's talk about, just so folks can hear the base mentality story, let's talk a little bit about how Buy was created and where it came from. I've read it's such a great story, and I'd love to just hear it from your own words.
My journey in beverage really started, I say it in the book, I really believe it was those kisses at the end of the night my mother gave me with coffee on her breath. that really left an emotional imprint.
I've had those, man. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because, you know, they got divorced and then she started dating and I was just a very nervous 7-year-old mommy's boy. And I'd wait up, at the front window for her to get home. Cause I just wanted her to get home. And when I saw those headlights come around the corner, I ran into bed and I faked like I was sleeping, and she'd invariably come up and give me a kiss goodnight, which I do to my daughter every day now. And it was that, because I was awake when she did it and I'd smell that coffee as she had gone out for dinner and had a cup of coffee. And I was like, that was for me, that was safe, right? That meant she was back. So I think there was this emotional connection with coffee, and that my career just started out in coffee and it stayed in and around coffee. I was always involved in coffee. I didn't grow up saying, oh, I want to be in coffee, or I want to, you know, start a Bevolution, or quite frankly, or I want to take sugar off the streets. That was not in me. What was in me was always, I was an entrepreneur from day one. As a kid, I always you know, created things and inspired people in my own
way. What
was
your first thing? What was your first business?
My mother will tell you that I had a pencil club as a kid. I do not recall doing that. I'm not saying it didn't happen because those things are just kind of intuitive to me. But my first business out of college, I just wanted to open up a coffee bar. And you got to remember, this is when coffee was starting to come on the scene with Starbucks. It was a big, you know, revolution of its own, that specialty coffee revolution. And it was a great industry, a lot of growth. And, you know, I just wanted to open up a coffee bar out of college. Yeah. And one thing led to another. That never transpired. So, you know, I was just that guy riding that city bus back from New York to New Jersey every day. I was working at my dad's little advertising agency at the time. And, you know, I had all this coffee knowledge because I had studied it. I had traveled abroad to just in Europe, understand the coffee culture. And I just wanted to bring it back here, but nobody was going to invest in it. So, I was doing something else. And then I just passed a big movie theater as the bus was going by. And I'm like, wow, you know, this is back in 92, 34, something like that. And, I was like, in any given weekend, there's a lot of people in that movie theater and they don't drink coffee there. So I took my coffee knowledge and I said, let's go make a coffee kind of kiosk in movie theaters. And I did that. And it seems like a very novel idea. You know, I was a 22-year-old at the time. And I traveled all over the country with this vision of what this can be. I'd go to all these movie houses and try to sell them on. And they all said the same thing, Michael. They were like, all right, great idea. But you know, who are you? What's Brute? I called it Brute Awakening. He goes, what's Brute Awakening? And I got Mars and Coke and Pepsi in my waiting room. You know, nice idea.
Yeah.
Except I went to one called National Movement who said the same exact thing. But then he said, go get a brand. If you get a brand, maybe I'll do something. And I went back to my dad who was doing point of purchase for alcohol. And one of the alcohols that he was working with was Godiva Liqueur. Okay. And it hit me because he got one of those little Godiva mailers and you know, monthly mailers. And I was just thumbing through it. I'm like, they're just coming out with a coffee. That's my brand. So I was able to get a meeting with Godiva as a 22-year-old. And I turned Brute Awakening, this thing called Cafe Cinema, which was very generic, into the Godiva Theater Cafe. And that was really my first invention, if you will, and business that actually generated some money. And that was a good feeling. It was a good feeling to see what ultimately became a display that sat in all these movie theaters and people drinking coffee and these little premium chocolates. And I'm like, wow, that was just it was just a thought in my head one day and it's actually happening. And that was intoxicating to see an idea actually commercialized like that, even on a small scale. I mean, we had 100 theaters, but I lived in those theaters. I mean, I lived in them to make sure that they were successful. And I was just, I knew I was, this is who I was. And, you know, every business thereafter, and there've been a number of both successes and failures, I always thought was going to be as big as Buy ultimately became.
Yeah.
And they became my obsessions. Every one of them became my obsessions.
Every one of your businesses has become your obsession. And how does that play out for you? You know, is it something that you dive in 110% and you just can't sleep? You live and breathe it until it comes to life. Or talk me through that.
Yeah. I'm like a dog on a bone with these businesses, to a fault. You know, some of these I probably should have left a lot sooner than I did. but I guess that's also what makes me unique is that I am unequivocally, I'm not afraid to fail in these businesses. And they take time and you've got to find your pivots along the way, because they don't come out, you know, perfect. So I like to say I'm patiently persistent. And it creates this obsession. It really does. And I think that's kind of the job of the entrepreneur is to be obsessed with it in an authentic way, in a believable way, right? Because if it's just an unreal expectation for the business, then you're leading others down a path that probably isn't fair to take them down. So I find the obsessions in them and I just kind of chase it and I stay tethered to them.
I have a friend who I was talking to the other day who's just starting a business and said to me, you know, I'm going to give this like 2 months. And if it doesn't work after 2 months, I don't know what I'm going to do.
like, isn't that great? Don't you wish you can do that with kids? I mean, in 2 months, if the kid doesn't, you know, stops crying, I'll keep it.
Yeah.
And these brands come out unhappy. I mean, they come out crying and, you know, it's just like a baby. You got to nurture them. And how could you put a time frame on it? Now, Listen, economics come into play, and maybe you only have 2 months of capital. Maybe you only have 2 months of vacation, and they think that in a vacation they could change their lives. Because most people are unhappy in their jobs, and they think that if there's an opportunity to get out, entrepreneurism feels like an opportunity to get out of a day job. But most often they're just creating a very expensive job for themselves, right? Yeah. So I think, you know, being tethered to it in an authentic way, and being obsessed with these ideas is critical. And you can't put a time frame against that.
So tell me about base mentality and how that is, you know, connected to just how you're describing, how you're just starting from these seeds of ideas and then transforming them into something that becomes tangible.
It's, you know, it's a mentality that we were able to capture through my personality and my experiences being an entrepreneur, not just by obviously culminating with buy, but I think I've said this before. I mean, I'm the same guy that I was in all of my businesses. I was as obsessed with all of them as I was with buy. And I've created this mentality that kind of ushers me through the process, not always to success, you know? And I think that's part of the journey of being an entrepreneur is, like I said, being okay if failure is the outcome. I've learned more from my failures than I have from my successes. And that mentality is what I look to, you know, evaluate in an entrepreneur and then kind of guide them. And it's often not about the idea, because the idea is either good or bad, commercially viable or not. And it's what you do in that first year when no one's looking to make it commercially viable or better. And that's their responsibility. It's not, I'm not a brand whisperer. I don't pretend to know the next big brand, especially quite frankly, outside of beverage. I'm kind of myopic, if you will. I'm really good at beverage, but you know, so I don't try to comment or impart my feelings on their product simply because I don't even know if they know their product yet. A lot of people get smitten with the ideas, like, oh, I can make something look good and find its role and relevance. But that takes time. That takes way more than 2 months. And that's their journey. I just kind of apply these base mentalities to their journey and give them some guidance along the way. Because there's a graveyard of great ideas. There's a graveyard of good entrepreneurs who just were not prepared for the journey.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the guidelines or the rules of base mentality.
Well, they're certainly not rules. I mean, they're just, and as you read the book, you'll see that they're just, you know, each book is a story along my journey, and the base mentality kind of encapsulates it with a lesson learned. And you know, it's very much not a how-to book. I don't have the how-tos on getting a brand from a basement to a $1.7 billion exit. I can tell you it starts with having a plan, and that plan is the responsibility of the entrepreneur to not just stay focused on creating the idea, but understanding you're going to be on a journey that's, you know, in our case, it was 9 years or 8 years, and that was a rocket ship. But it was 8 years of not getting paid, you know, and then maybe getting underpaid for a couple of years at the end. And it's all sacrifices along the way. So you better be tethered to something that's realistic, especially if you're going to ask others to do the same thing alongside you. But I think the beauty of it, and I think it's told in the book, is that when you can dream alongside people you truly love and inspire them to all be like-minded in what you see and own it for themselves, that vision, there's nothing more beautiful in business. It's like a ballet, right? It just comes together where your vision, your audacious vision, and all the hard work kind of seamlessly happen. That's what you chase as an entrepreneur. You know, I can't give you lessons to do that other than you got to be patiently persistent. You got to be realistic. You got to be realistic with your brand, right? You got to say, you know, are the vitals of this brand what I thought they were? Are they healthy? And if not, what do I have to do to make them healthy? Or is it a kind of a lost cause? And I've had lost causes in my, you know, career. There's no question. And I think about one of them, and anyway, I just didn't even use the product. And if you don't use your product, you're not authentically tethered to it. So, I mean, there are signs and signals. I often speak to entrepreneurs who are just kind of getting started, and it's more of preparation. But, you know, there are situations where you look at an entrepreneur and they're already on their journey, and you see that certain things of that journey have kind of broken, and some of them are beyond repair, and some of them, you know, just kind of make your pivots. Hope you don't run out of money.
Yeah. When you started Crook and Marker, were you thinking, man, I sold this other company for $1.7 billion. That ain't enough money. Or were you thinking, God, I just love to do this. Like, let's go back to the basement and find that seed. Like, what's the next seed for me? What's the drive for you to do something? And when you're doing Crook and Marker now, do you feel the same way that you did when you were starting by?
So it's a great question. And Michael, maybe you and I know each other for all of, 30 minutes. So, but yet I think we're very like-minded. So I hope you understand or know the answer to this is never, ever about the money. Now, money plays into it because you're often borrowing a lot of it from either a bank or people you know or people you don't know. And it becomes about money. And if you don't think about the money, you're being irresponsible in the game. So I'm not going to discount the money. But there's only so much money one person can have. So it's definitely not about, I see some celebrities today that are trying to shape themselves as a billionaire, and they're just trying to collect all these reasons why they are on Forbes billionaire list. And it's a race to get on that list. For me, I don't care about any of that. To me, it's about the journey. I know that sounds a little hokey, but if you were here, Michael, and you understood that after this conversation, I'm going back down literally into the basement to continue to build out the next big idea. It's just who I am. I'm actually, without being tethered to a big idea, I'm just not as fun to be around. I'm better if part of me is in the future. I've kind of proven that I could affect people's lives in that regard, but I'm also just, I'm a bit healthier in that regard. I think I'm a better parent. I think I'm a better husband because I stay tethered. And it's not like it's almost in a very selfless way because it's not about me. It's not about my idea. As soon as I'm tethered to an idea, I look to collect people because it can't be just me. I will never be successful. So it's that collaboration, and we're all chasing. And it's the reason why I called my family office Dela, right? It's about dreaming alongside your loved ones. So I actually think that collaboration, makes me a better person, but it makes other people around me better because it gives us purpose and we're chasing something.
One of my favorite things about being a musician and about being a filmmaker is that connection you have with other people. So like, for example, I sit down and I say, I'm going to write a song. And I always write songs from either what breaks my heart or from what is bringing me incredible joy. And I sit down and I go, my father just passed away. So I'm sitting here thinking, like, I really want to write this song about my dad. And then I go and I work with somebody else. And there was a long time in my music writing career where I thought, if I am going to share this songwriting process with somebody else, it's going to make it less personal to me because it's not just going to be about my feelings. But as I grew as an artist, I learned that you actually get more from it. I actually get more from it when I sit down and I write a song about my dad with another writer who says, I've had similar feelings, or I had feelings in a different way that can maybe give you some perspective on your experience. Do you find the same thing when you're collaborating with people that the magic really starts to roll over, and what you first thought was your great idea, you really realizes maybe just one little small part of it, but there's 10 other people who came to the table with other incredible things.
Yeah. So there's a chapter in the book called Royals, Rebels, and Randoms. And that's how we look to involve people in our businesses. And, I love the randoms, right? Because randoms make the engine go. They are the ones that are doing that need the company and the purpose of the company, or in your case, the song, as much as, the company needs them. And when you find those people, they insert their passion into it. And it's just like what you said about writing a song. there's a lot of people that feel like you feel. In fact, they're the people that are buying your albums, right? Because they want to hear something. But there's also a lot of people that are going through what you're going through, right? And they could have a voice, right? And together, your voice could be even more powerful. You know, you remind me a whole hell of a lot of a good friend of mine, Zach Brown, who I speak about this stuff all the time. And I think what makes his music so great as well is that it just, they're stories. You guys, at the end of the day, are storytellers. You come to the House of Crook here, and you talk to people, you forget that we sell a beverage, because it's not about that. It's a bigger story. It's about being a marker, a black sheep, you know, thinking differently and not being penned in with the crook. That's what the name Crook and Marker. And not to make this a selfless, you know, promote for my business, but you know, the point I'm trying to make is, you know, I want to take people on a journey that's bigger than beverage. Because at the end of the day, if you just remind me I'm in beverage, I kind of like, you know, it's time to retire. So you often need to tap into other people's emotion along that journey, because they're all drawn to the same thing. And I've had, you know, listen, I've had some good ideas, but I've also listened to a lot of good ideas and probably done more with those ideas than the people who could actually have them. Yeah. And that's the role you play and I play as artists. And I just feel like I'm an artist here. I'm just drawing something here. So I need to take things out of people's heads and make them reality, because a lot of times they can't do it themselves.
Mm-hmm. With Crook and Marker, you know, why are you doing, I guess the way, what I'm trying to say is, with Bai, you identified that there needed to be soft drinks that weren't loaded with tons of sugar. And with Crook and Marker, you're doing the same thing in a way with alcohol. Talk to me about it.
Well, you know, I kind of followed this consumer. They always say that I'm a disruptor. The reality is this millennial consumer is very disruptive, and they're big, 80 million strong. And we helped kind of shape their drinking habits on the non-alc side, because they were just done with sugar and didn't want to consume those calories. And we just gave them the vehicle to do that. That's an oversimplification of it, but it was at the expense of a big behemoth in soda. So you had all this share of stomach coming out of soda and a consumer that was just looking for a alternative. And we were able to accomplish it. But we also developed a relationship with them. And then in 2017, Michael, something very unique happened. They all turned 21. The whole demographic became of legal drinking age. So what they did was they just took their drinking habits and they applied it to beer. And they said, you know, I'm not going to drink the carbs and the calories anymore. I want an alternative. And then you saw the growth of seltzer in alcohol, and it's a huge category. It saved the beer category. And I just understood what was happening, which was seltzer is just a sign of things to come, because people will leave hard seltzer as quickly as they ran to it. It's just a safe place to go because it's not beer. And quite frankly, it's not much. It's kind of bland. Mm-hmm. And that to me was a signal that there needs to be a solution beyond seltzer. And I saw a great opportunity to continue disruption in beverage, because the beverage industry is broken. And I like being around it, because I feel like I could do my part in fixing it. And in this case, you know, we had an opportunity to create an alcohol that was made from these organic ancient grains, that was USDA certified organic, that had big, bold flavor with that you can trust. And that's really the answer beyond seltzer. And then, you know, you get into it where there's all this growth in a category that is distracting it, you know, for good reason, distributors from thinking about anything else except selling a lot of seltzer, because it's saving their business. And I'm kind of knocking on the door. I'm like, be careful. Don't get too comfortable with seltzer. We have the answer. And they're like, okay. And I got that. And for the first year or two, it was a lot of like just resistance in what we were doing. Yet we were growing a business that was substantial. So it just gave me really, really, although when I talk about taking those vitals of the business, well, the vitals in this one were strong. Now, there's a lot of ignorance that stands in front of what a consumer wants and what they get. And that's why I'm in business, right? I'm actually carrying a coin right now. I carry it all the time. It says a posse ad esse, which means from potential to being. And on the other side, it says virtus morsets in adversario, which is virtuous feeble without an adversary. So when I go to work every day, I really don't even think about the customer anymore. I think about everything that stands in the way of getting the customer what they really want. And I'm very confident that the product is what they want. So it's about retailers, it's about distributors, it's about big business, it's about commerce and everything that stands in the way of just giving people what they want, a better option. And I'm really good in that environment because it kind of gives me my edge because I get angry, right? So I'm like, okay, you know, we're going to go toe-to-toe here. And, you know, that takes, obviously it takes money, it takes time, it takes persistence, it takes a good product. And then on top of all that, it takes luck. You got to have a lot of luck. You know, I could miss the window here and just, yeah. You know, and I go to, you know, where I could be on a beach. I go to work every day, you know, a little edge, a little anger, you know, and I'm in the same neighborhood, almost the same building I was with Bai, and I'm happy. And I like doing that. And I guess that fight that I refer to just gives me purpose. And, and to see the little wins, like we're collecting some really good wins. And it keeps me tethered to the big dream. And I'm just more excited about it today than even when we started.
When start with a beverage. Do you see it in your head? Do you see the whole thing? Like you actually see the bottle, you see it on the shelf, you see somebody picking it up. Cause to me, I'm not a beverage person. So if I'm thinking of a beverage, it's really hard for me to see the face of it. You know, like, what is it? What does the bottle look like? What is the graphics? Like, how does that come to be?
I do see all that. And it's not always 100% clear, but I do see that, but it's a small part of a bigger vision that I see. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of entrepreneurs get caught up on making it look good, taste good, perfect placement of every, you know, every component of the label and chase perfection in the can. I mean, we do all that to an extent, but I'm the kind of guy that sees that, in front of a landscape of something much bigger. And I think that's important because if you don't have that bigger perspective, then you're almost blind to where you're going. And I don't know how you can ever take money from people without a plan. And you can't really have a plan without a vision. Like I always start here and I work my way back to the product, right? So for me, you know, the reason with Crooked Market, I saw 80 million people that I know don't want beer, that I know are sacrificing. And then as a result, I can say, okay, what is the value of the category behind beer? And I spent some time trying to figure out with logic, what is that worth? And is it worth the next 9 years of my life changing? Is it worth whoever's going to put money into this? Is it worth putting in capital? Is it worth convincing other people to quit whatever they're doing and join this? And I have a stronger vision for that than even the product. That's why I'm more confident in the product because we've done this before and I know the consumer. So specifically on this venture, I'm more focused on the opportunity. And I think that's a lesson that I try to impart on a lot of entrepreneurs, which is, it's great. You know, it's a beautiful version of a espresso martini. And you feel like the world needs that in a can. Okay. Now convince me why and how big and how long is it going to take you to get there? What is the opportunity? Why would you disrupt somebody enough to have them buy it? And, you know, how are you going to pay people back? I mean, it's not what they want to hear. Because it's so easy just to dream about, hey, wouldn't it be great to crack open an espresso martini with a friend and share it? But that journey, yes, it requires that belief in it, right? And it requires you obsessing over the product so it tastes great and it looks as good as it can look. But it's really, you know, it wins or loses based on your plan. And my plans are never perfect. And I always, like I thought Bai would sell for $3.5 billion when I started. Didn't. But, you know, I had a plan, and in having a plan and listening to the brand and the consumer early on, I was able to succeed by failing. Right. Mm-hmm.
This last week, I watched an interview with Chip Berg, who's the CEO of Levi's, and he went on CNN and he was talking about voting rights. And how in so many states that there's these new voting bills that are being passed to basically limit voting rights. And he was part of a group of, 50 or 60 other CEOs around the country who were signing on to speak out against these voting rights laws. And then this week, with the killing of Dante Wright in Minnesota, the NHL, Major League Baseball, and the NBA have all decided to stop doing their games there, postpone the games there. We're starting to see business and CEOs step into the political realm. What do you think about that? Do you think that's a good thing? Do you think it's a bad thing? Is it something that you do personally? I know you have a strong vision of ways that you can contribute to the world through your products, but do you feel like getting directly involved in political stuff is important for your business to do, or important for your business to stay out of? And this generation of millennials are really blurring the lines. You know, like you see a lot of athletes today who are doing speaking out in that regard, who in past years wouldn't have before. So What do you think about that?
Well, I've never been politically motivated, nor do I see personally its role in building a business. But listen, if somebody has strong political views on specifically some of those topics that you mentioned, which are so right now at the top of mind, then they should express them. I'm a big believer in that. But you better be able to have that conversation, you know, all the way through. I'm not sure I'm that guy that, you know, if I were to have that conversation, I could fully commit to the conversation. Mm-hmm. Not because I don't have a perspective on it, just because I don't know if my voice is as relevant there. I don't spend a lot of time in that arena. Have a lot of respect for that. I mean, I do have my opinions on all of those things. But I haven't been the guy that's been very politically motivated throughout my career. You know, I kind of make drinks for a living. You know, I think right now, and maybe that'll change as I get older. I feel like I change the world in my own little way, and I try to stay in that lane.
I think that what you guys are doing actually is changing the world. And it's changing the way that people think about their health. It's changing the way that people think about their beverage consumption, just drinking calories. But I think that where you guys are winning the most is that you're, like what you described before, people are sacrificing by drinking beer. People aren't sacrificing by drinking Crook and Marker. Is there something after this that you've already thinking about, or is there like?
In product wise, yes and no. Like I said, I get all consumed with what I'm doing. In part, that probably does soften my voice elsewhere because I'm very focused on this. But when I say this, you know, even when you say beverage, I do kind of in my mind roll my eyes. And I have all the respect, and I love the industry in which I'm in. I think consuming a beverage is a personal thing, and it's done on, more often than eating, you're drinking. So I think that being responsible there is important, and I love the impact that I've had alongside some great people in shaping those attitudes towards it. But really, what I want as a legacy is I want people, like in the name Crook and Marker, I want people to kind of be unbound in how they think. Be a standout. Stand up to, you know, big business, and in my case, big soda and big industry. And do it for all the right reasons. And don't be afraid to fail as you're doing it. And I think when you get intimate with the brand, you kind of peel back the layers that speak to the beverage and you realize there's a bigger brand there. I would love on the heels of Crook and Marker to really, and Crook and Marker is doing a better job of it than Bai, because we had a very similar culture, but I've literally put in the name here. And my goal here is to ultimately become bigger than beverage. That doesn't mean I'm politically motivated. I'm not looking for, you know, to run for office or anything like that. But I do feel like I have a voice that resonates at times with people. And I think I have a practicality to what I say without a bias. And I think that, you know, in imparting that on people has been very gratifying to me. Watching people become great because of, you know, certain mentalities that I've applied to business and they can apply to business or beyond business. Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, once you turn 50, you start thinking about, you know, what's the bigger calling? And now, you know, like I said, Quicken Marker, it's like raising another child. So it is all consuming, but I am doing it with this sense of what is next. So I do think about that more than I ever did.
Yeah. I got one last question for you. And it's a question I ask everybody who's on this podcast, which is, what does it mean to you to be human and how do you stay that way? How do you stay human?
Well, this is being human, is having a conversation like this and being challenged. You know, I think in a way you're challenging me to think bigger. And I appreciate that because I don't spend a lot of time challenging myself for that. And that's a part of being human to me, is understand, just like you said earlier, you know, sometimes you don't write the best song. Sometimes the guy next to you had a better idea. And that's very human of you to say that, because in a way you're saying you're showing your vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So for me, staying human is about showing vulnerability and understanding that, you know, every interaction you have, there's a learning there and you don't have all the answers. Often those people will put in front of you in your presence to maybe influence you in that way or guide you. And staying open to the fact that you're not perfect, I think, makes you human.
Hmm. Man, it's been awesome to talk to you. And I'm super inspired. I love what you do. And like I told you before, I was an early adopter of Bi, man. I remember the very first time that it came onto our tour bus and everybody on the bus, I was like, you got to try this shit, man. And they were drinking. And then I go, look how many calories in there. And it quickly replaced, you know, a lot of soda on our bus. So I just want to thank you for making our band healthier in that way. And just creating great options. And as my wife would also like to thank you, making great cocktails with Bite.
Well, listen, I want, first of all, thank you for that. I'm just a guy who makes drinks. I've had some success at it, but I want to thank you for taking the time to have a conversation with me. And yeah, for me, it's about collecting good people in your life, whether you know them for 30 minutes or you've known them for 10 years, you could connect with people who are like-minded and think the way you think, not just about the product or the business you're in, but about life. So I appreciate the conversation. I hope we could have more of them. I really enjoyed meeting you.
Right on. Likewise. Yeah, folks, thanks for tuning into this week's Stay Human podcast with Ben Weiss. And we want to give thanks to Gibson Guitars for sponsoring the show. And we'll be back next week with another awesome guest. But in the meantime, go out and have some Bi, have a Quicken Marker on me, and I'll be toasting you from wherever we're sharing this. All right. Peace, Ben.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.